Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Mon.
And welcome back to Master of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman. What's up, everybody? We're back. We're here. This is exciting. It's round two, and we're talking Modern.
So today we're talking about the Mythic Championship, and we're also going to be talking about your time at GP Portland this last weekend, because you played an actual GP.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the decks. I gave my brother a deck. I took him with me. I took a version of Kessel Runs. We'll be recapping all that, all the new stuff.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter. I am at Kess Wiley.
I'm at Ben Bateman Media.
We are at the MMCast. And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. We do a live stream. We're doing it right now. In fact, if you watch the live stream, you would have heard us do this whole intro one time, and now you get to hear it again for live stream people. And then if you're not on YouTube right now, check it out. You get to interact with us in person. For instance, someone just told us that we should saran wrap all of our cards so that they have card sleeves to protect them, which I thought was funny.
There would be a severe amount of glare.
So much clearer. But yeah, so definitely subscribe to YouTube, comment there, share it once the video goes live as a regular video versus the audio live feed, and yeah, that's fun.
I think it's a good intro. Be sure to subscribe on YouTube. Comment, like, subscribe, all those things. It is literally right now with what we're doing with the show the most important thing you can possibly do to help us. We have a Patreon. That's a great way to help us. But in terms of awareness and getting this brand out there so more people hear about it, YouTube is the thing we're really pushing right now. So like, subscribe, comment, and yeah, thanks for tuning in. So
here's
Alex.
K and Z, who's recommended that we sleeve our cards, and then Benjamin Wayland was like, you need a whole wrap of saran wrap.
I mean, we could try it. I'm not opposed.
I would do it as a bonus thing at the end of an episode next week or something along those lines.
The actual video of us saran wrapping a card?
Yeah, and then we just post it.
That's weird.
Are these Deckmaster game cards? Do they have anything on
that?
Yeah. No. All right. So tell me on the road to GP Portland.
Well, I knew that any modern Grand Prix that is somewhat local, I try to make an effort to get to. I'm from Seattle originally. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, so this one felt like a good one, and my older brother, who is about 10 years older than me, taught me how to play Magic when I was 5 years old. That was when I learned how to play, and so I've been playing ever since. And he doesn't really play Magic anymore. Like, he doesn't really have people to play with, but he likes it, and he enjoys it when we play. But, I mean, he's at best, like, a draft player, you know, like, plays sorcerer, plays like, instance main phase kind of guy. Like, just not like somebody who plays Magic. He, like, played Magic.
I would say, but he's like a draft player, I feel like.
I'm saying, like,
draft years are
5 years ago he drafted for, like, the last time. Like, he's
got it.
Like, my brother just is not somebody who plays a lot of Magic. He plays a ton of Hearthstone. He's, like, forgotten the rules of Magic in some ways. But I was like, Modern's really fun. It's not that complicated. You'll be fine. You should just play a deck. And he's like, cool, whatever. So I put Mono Red Phoenix together because I thought it was a cool deck list and it seemed like a reasonable deck to give someone.
How did he do?
He did better than I did.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he started out 2-0.
Welcome
sweet.
To playing good lists.
I know.
Into a GP instead of like...
He was literally like, why didn't you just play this deck? And I was like, shut up. He's like, why didn't you just play a good list of Magic cards?
So I have a question, because we have... And we'll get into the list you played in a second, but in all of the GPs you've gone to, often... And even going towards the old PTQ era playing, like, you have this inherent problem with playing established deck in archetypes, probably because you feel like when you play an established deck archetype, if you just lose throughout the tournament, or because you feel like you don't have an edge with this deck because you're just not going to be as good as other players with it, you don't want to spend the day losing because while playing a good deck, you'd rather lose with a bad deck than lose with a good deck. Is kind of your philosophy behind it.
Kind of, yeah. That's fairly accurate.
When
was
the last time you took a stock list to a major GP or large tournament?
I mean, I can count on one hand probably the number of times I've done it.
Okay.
Like a stock list. Like, there was a SCG LA where I took mono black devotion and standard at one point.
Okay.
And I scrubbed out really hard and it was just miserable. It wasn't fun to play. The format was boring, I thought. And it just was like, this is stupid. Why did I do this? I remember I did that once. I took a Rug Delver list back to a PTQ in the first couple years of Modern. Like, probably back in, like, 2012 or 13.
Okay.
And I did really well with it. I think, like, it was an 8-round PTQ, and I think it was, like, I went, like, 5-2-1, maybe.
Okay.
Almost. I finished 21st or something like that.
Okay.
And I remember that was really cool. I liked that deck. And it's also, like, sort of my style still, so it was doable.
Mm-hmm.
I took a mono blue merfolk list, and I remember adding some green to it before they printed the good green cards, but, like, I played Collected Company, I think, in it. That was close to a stock list, like, you know, maybe with five or six different cards.
Okay, okay.
But it's, like, not very many times. Normally, it's, like, I've, you know, taken Superior Burning Cocoa, or I take that weird retrace list, or I take, like, that Greater Gargadon, Steal Your Stuff list that they changed the rules, or Hunted Handsome, or... I mean, I've tried all these things.
And so based on your last experience with GPs, I have a challenge for you on the next GP you go to.
Okay.
And that's to take a stock list.
Just to try out a good deck.
A good deck that, like, did well in the last weekend.
Just go for it.
Yeah.
Nah. Maybe. I mean, I would have ended up with one of the Phoenix lists. I would have ended up either with the blue-red list that was the only deck anyone played that weekend, or the mono-red list.
Sure. Probably. And that mono, you know, the Phoenix deck got two into the top eight, and one was ninth place. Manamorphos, Faith is Looting, Arc Like Phoenix, Thing in the Ice, Thought Scour, and Oct, and Seer Visions, and Lightning Bolt made up, were all in the top 10 cards. The only non-Phoenix cards were... nope. All of them. Every one of these cards. Is Surgical Attraction played in Phoenix decks? Yeah. Every single card in the top 10 is a Phoenix card.
Yeah. I mean, it was powerful. I played against Blue-Red Phoenix. I'll take your challenge. That's fine. Okay. I have to look with the next GP, the next modern...
GPLA March, I think.
GPLA March is the next modern one?
The next modern one's close, I think.
Okay. Yeah, and that's a reasonable... That's, like, I realized this morning that I counted of the next 70 days. Mm-hmm. I think I'm out of LA for 38 of them. So, there.
Next.
you'll be with me for a solid 3 weeks of that.
Yeah. Going to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So anyone in Hong Kong who wants to hang out, we're going to be there for 2 weeks.
And New York, like a few weeks later for a week.
Yeah. New York's harder.
Oh, you're never hanging out. I'm saying that's where you and I are going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just I was thinking the actual number of available opportunities for me to play Magic, it's going to be very, very low, I think. So March is probably actually when my schedule will even kind of free up. Do you know the date on March, Michael?
I'll find out.
I mean, the reason I bring this up is the amount of GPs that I've gone to that I do well in that are limited versus modern, I, like, do better in the limited ones. And I think that's probably because I just play the best possible deck given to me in limited. Versus at
me too.
I'm like, oh, I really want to try out this cool strategy, and like the best testing environment is a GP, so I want to see what it does.
Colton has an interesting question here. If you see, it ran out of the chat, but you can probably pick it up there. Read it into the mic.
Brandon Russell.
Brandon S. Russell?
Yeah. Is it step one, post Bateman brew to tappedout.net? Step two, use that stock list. Is that what you want me to read?
No. Brandon, long-time fan of you. I appreciate the candor there.
Do I think there are cards that are still ran in good, that are no longer good but ran in lists because they just have momentum and that they shouldn't be ran there? Is that the one you're asking?
Yes. I think that's an interesting question. Like, basically, based on the past history of a card's success, are there cards that we think lists still run that they shouldn't be running anymore because, like, the format doesn't support it, but, like, they've been good for so long that... I mean, a card like this would be, like, let's just say Kitchen Finks was no longer really good in Modern, but people just kept running it in all of those colored decks because it's been so good for so long.
And the problem with Kitchen Finks is that it's, like, an inherent piece of multiple combos and, like, does something in a specific way there, and those combos might be bad, and Collected Company decks haven't done well in Modern for almost a year. I think, like, there are times when Lightning Bolt is bad and people play it just because they don't know it's bad. Like,
and bad's a relative term because 3 damage to any target for 1 red is really good. Like, that's just a good thing.
Well, but that's kind of, like, sometimes it's not, and that's kind of the point, is, like, the format moves away from it.
What's the date?
I didn't realize there was so much Modern on the West Coast.
What do we got?
Oakland is Modern on January 4th, but you're in Hong Kong, right?
Yeah.
I would be there for
that.
So
then March 1st is...
Oh,
March.
It's right around the corner. We'll have gotten back...
Yeah, we'll be here.
Life never stops.
Yeah.
We'll be, like, so jet lagged.
It'll be a year anniversary for my bachelor party.
Yeah, all
right. It's like the 1-2 week window that we know we'll actually be here.
March 1st, I will play some kind of good stock list. That's what I'll do. It's a promise. You have my word on the show.
Yeah, we'll be like right off the back of New York Toy Fair. We can do some testing in New York Toy Fair.
Be great. Yeah, exciting.
Want to help Ben test Modern in New York City?
Yeah.
During New York Toy Fair, just hang out with with him in the hotel room. He was going to be exhausted from toy things.
Probably the hotel lobby. I don't know if we're going to be hanging out in hotel rooms, but...
It's fair.
But all right, so getting back to it, you know, I took my brother with me. I gave him Mono Red Phoenix. He was excited. He was a really good sport about it, too. Like, honestly, you should have seen... Like, I wasn't, like, watching, but you should have seen him. This is, like, the microcosm of somebody who knows how to play Magic, but you give a modern deck, and you expect him to play in a modern Grand Prix for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He was like... Ah, I played against this one deck, and he was playing all these lands that came in tapped, and, like, this card that untapped him, and, like, he was going so fast. The guy wouldn't even, like, really look him in the face. He was, like, shuffling his cards really fast. I was like, whoa, bro, I'm sure what you're saying is right, but I got to read each of these lands. Like,
I feel like in that situation, having your brother just, like, call a judge over and being like, I don't totally understand what his deck is trying to do. I'm a little bit new to the format. Can you keep an eye on him and make sure? Because a judge will do that. I mean, they don't, like...
It's more intimidating to call a judge as a new player, though, for sure.
It is. I used to be super timid about calling
Oh, because you think you're, like, a snitch. Like, that. Like it feels much more like snitches get stitches, and you're just like, no, I don't want to do this. It's like, I don't want to be an asshole, but, like, in reality, like...
Yeah,
call judges.
It was funny. It was funny to hear him like giving his each match.
I was thinking. I wish you recorded that and we had that available as like an entire video like segment of just like you and your brother talking about his matchups and what they are, and then you like don't tell him that this is like a known quantity.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, oh, this one. Yeah,
all the decks he played were. Actually, I think he played against one weird brew that I didn't quite understand what the hell he was saying, but
okay. But
everything else they were all real. So, but anyway, it was fun to go with him and like, you know, it was interesting, right? Like this is actually probably cool for you guys to hear because some of you are maybe newer listeners. I was trying to figure out in my mind explaining to someone who it was their first constructed GP ever. So not just modern, but how do you explain to somebody this is what you're going to experience? These are the things to be aware of, right? And then secondly, like. Because it's modern, these are the things in modern that people do. These are going to happen to you. You need to be prepared for this. And, like, that was a, you know, I was like, okay, for instance, your deck is extraordinarily reliant on your graveyard. There's this card called Rest in Peace. Any deck that has white is going to be playing this card against you. It's going to happen in game two almost every single time. Because the whole format is all about graveyards right now. And that Bedlam Reveler card is very bad if you don't have a graveyard. And I was like, and this other card, Arclight Phoenix, is useless if you don't have a graveyard. So they're going to...
not true. Yeah. But casting a 3-2 haze flyer is good.
Totally. And we had that conversation too. But so it was interesting. Like
it's fine.
Those conversations. And then also saying stuff to him like...
Well, yeah. Trying to give him like... useful like rules of thumb. Because like Rest in Peace, not every deck is going to be playing Rest in Peace because most decks play with the graveyard themselves. But they're going to have graveyard hate.
Yeah.
And like trying to convince them like there's just cards that are going to wreck your graveyard and being aware of them in game two is hard to just get that across.
Right. I like when we were testing, like I had Leyland of Sanctity in my sideboard and I like started a game with it. And I was like, this is going to be hard for you. And he's like, what? And I was like, this is going to happen. This is the thing. When you're burn spells, you can't target me anymore. So... this is, and it's, again, people are going to have this. It's going to be annoying to you. You're going to feel like you would have won the game if they didn't have this card, but that's what modern is. So the other lesson I tried to give him was like, you're new to this, to constructed Magic period and a really complicated format. You're going to make mistakes and they're going to cost you games and it's going to be really frustrating. Mm-hmm. It happens to me too, but it's going to happen to you because you're going to miss an interaction or a trigger. Don't tilt. Whatever you do, don't tilt and get frustrated because it's just impossible to go into this and expect. And he went in and he played really well. Like I said, he started 2-0. I think in the end, you know, he maybe went like 3-3 when we dropped. But like I think at one point he was 3-1, which I was like, that's pretty cool. That's pretty hard to do if you're like have never played a game of Constructed Magic at a GP before. So that was fun. On my end, I was playing the Kessel Run. So we probably will post the list that I played. Mm-hmm. But I can kind of give a gist of it here if you guys don't know the deck we're talking about. This is a deck that Alex had kind of conceptualized about 6 months or 8 months ago.
Well, the deck just started out as a straight-up blue-white-red list that, like, played good planeswalkers, played good control spells, and then, like, this was earlier in the Teferi era when we really kind of created this deck, and I wanted convenient, quick ways to close out games, and I was getting frustrated with like how long it was taking, and I would lose to just like people being faster than me and having some way to just be like, oh, I win, oops. And I was bouncing between doing actually a Through the Breach Emrakul deck, and I don't have Through the Breaches now, I have one. or doing a Kiki Congo Angel combo. And I love Restoration Angel. Restoration Angel is probably one of the best, my favorite cards of all time.
Yeah.
And so leaning into the Kiki Jiki Resto combo was something that I was trying out. And then leading into GP...
Vegas. Yep.
I had this and a few other decks, but like you wanted to try out this combo, but adding Felidar Guardian and Saheeli into the deck. Because you were messing around with Saheeli decks for a while at that point.
Yeah, I think I took your 75 and I probably changed out about 15 cards.
Right.
Give or take, maybe 20, including the sideboard. We messed around with the numbers and added a few things, and it did pretty well at Vegas. Some of you guys probably remember I played this deck on coverage in round two or three. Round two.
Before people got off buys.
Yeah, and it was pretty cool. It did pretty well. Like, I think I started that tournament out maybe like 301 or something like that before I started losing. I can't quite remember, but it was a strong enough performance, and I liked the deck. And we changed it around for this GP. The meta was a little bit worse. This time through, what I found was that it really felt bad playing so many Sorcery Speed 4 and 5 drops. Like, Kiki Jiki, Teferi, Jace, it just felt really clunky.
Mm-hmm.
Felidar Guardian, you know, the one of was in there. Even Saheeli felt really underpowered. Like, the decks that I was playing against were just doing so much in the first couple turns.
I think Saheeli has always felt a little underpowered. Like, the one times that she's been good is when she's like, I win by having this in play.
And we were playing a one of anyway, so... But just all the Planeswalkers just didn't feel like they were affecting the board enough.
Partly because the way the deck is built is, like... Because you're going for the combo plan, and that's really what you're trying to do, having Planeswalkers are better when you're playing a control plan. So what you're doing is, before you play that Planeswalker, is just stopping them from doing anything. So when you play it, it becomes this value engine that keeps you being able to stop them what they're doing. And what you're trying to do is be proactive, and the Planeswalkers you're playing aren't great for proactiveness. You want... A proactive Planeswalker is Elsbeth, and even she's probably not that good
now. It's also really hard to stop them from doing what they're doing in Modern when... Like, okay, we're a three-color mana base that was playing 8 fetch lands and 5 shocks. Mm-hmm. With 5 basics, 4 colonnades, and then a couple colorless lands. Like, I think we were playing... We had been playing 2 Field of Ruin, and I replaced one of them with the Seraph Sanctuary for the Infinite Life combo.
Mm-hmm.
But, like...
Well, but, like, in the top 8 of the tournament... Wait, continue, sorry.
In the first few turns of the game, you were almost every single game going to 14. Like... Almost every single game.
Because of the mana base.
Because of the mana base. So trying to stop people from what they're doing, making sure you're both hitting your land drops, and also keeping a hand that's doing anything, and also not just dying to aggressive creatures, starting the game at basically 14 life, it was rough. I mean, that was I think the mana base and the pain of the mana base was one of the hardest parts of the whole deck.
But I mean, yes, but I mean, 3-color decks can make it work. I mean, the problem with it is that you're playing double blue and double red, which has its own challenges. But And that's kind of the point. But I think control decks, like a blue-black control deck, top 8 of this tournament, like straight blue-black with like...
Yeah, but that's blue-black. I mean, what you just said is like, I have to play untapped lands and make sure I'm hitting red and blue early. So.
Well, but like Grixis, I mean, there's been decks in the history of Modern that have survived playing 3-color mana bases pretty easily.
But they don't need to hit triple red.
Right, that's the and you have no other reason to be in triple red is the problem.
So the Kiki Jiki combo with Restoration Angel is the A combo. In the end, I elected to play 3 Restoration Angel and 2 Kiki Jiki, along with 3 Jace and 2 Teferi. And then I played a single Felidar Guardian, a single Saheeli Ray, and 1 Seraph Sanctuary. Seraph Sanctuary was the coolest tech, and I actually have more faith in this side of the combo than the other one now.
Right, like, I guess what my point this whole time has been is I think that there's a version of that combo of just, like, Kiki Jiki, Sarah...
Restoration Angel.
Restoration Angel and Felidar Guardian and the Seraph Sanctum that works, just not in a blue-white-red control shell.
So, yeah, my goal would be in the future, I think, to maybe shift away from blue. Like, so the combo we're talking about, guys, is the Seraph Sanctuary is a land from Avacyn Restored. It's colorless, comes into play untapped. When it enters the battlefield, you gain a life. And whenever an angel enters the battlefield under your control, you gain 1 life. So if you are able to, obviously, go infinite with Kiki Jiki and Restoration Angel, you attack for 1,000,000 damage. But
or Felidar Guardian. Both of them work with Kiki Jiki to go infinite.
Yeah.
But what the land lets you do...
is that if you have a single Felidar Guardian, and you have Restoration Angel and the land in play, you can end of their turn flash in Resto, targeting Felidar Guardian, and at the end of their turn, they blink each other infinitely. One's an angel, you gain infinite life.
Right, because the Restoration Angel can't do it with himself. Like, two Restoration Angels can't do this because they can't target angels, but because Velogarnar is not an angel, they can go back and forth and you gain infinite life because one's an angel, one isn't, and you go...
Yeah, and there's almost no card ever printed. In fact, I think Felidar Guardian, at its cost maybe, is the only one that's ever been printed that blinks a permanent instantly. Like, that does not an end-of-turn blink, but a same turn enters the battlefield blink. I don't think there's a single other card you can play that costs four or less. Yeah.
Four or less, that's a creature, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why it's so unique. But there's, I think there's something there. Like, I could see this being more of a white-red prison deck almost.
Yeah, the list I've been messing around with, and you know, obviously this deck kind of exists, is the Eldritch Evolution, all your creatures enter the battlefield, they're relatively aggressive, you play with Kitchen Finks, you play with Blade Splicers, and you play with good one-drops and two-drops, you play with Birds of Paradise, And the deck, the purpose of the deck is more just to kind of go off
with
value creatures, and then Restoration Angel and Felidar Guardian are more about blinking those value creatures to gain the value again. You play with that card right there. The name is being blocked. Knight of Autumn.
Knight of Autumn.
Yeah. You play with like Knight of Autumns, and you get like all these good value creatures that like then. Because the other problem I think that our version of the deck had with blue, white, red control is that because so many of the cards you're playing are control decks and planeswalkers, blinking them with Restoration Angel, you don't have that many good targets. You just really have Snapcaster Mage and Wall of Omens.
Yeah.
And when those are your two targets, they're not that... It you don't have that many good things to be blinking. And like you want to kind of maximize the amount of stuff you get value off of with those cards if you're really going to go for that plan. And Kiki Jiki kind of does it too. Like, playing Kiki Jiki and just copying Blade Splicers six turns in a row is going to win you the game.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to go infinite with it. It can just be another Restoration Angel.
Kiki Jiki is really tough. It's like, it's just, I know it has haste and it wins the game, but it just feels, when you draw in your opening hand, it just feels so bad.
Which is, I think, why, like, people are cutting, you, like, cut down to two or one Kiki Jiki, but you're playing some amount of Eldritch Evolutions and some amount of...
Angels.
Cord of Calling, so that you can just tutor for it when you need to.
Well, because there's, like, the four colors of Healy deck, which is kind of doing that. It's a similar kind of deck.
And I just think that Healy is bad.
Yeah, I mean, I might even play...
Like, I think Eldritch Evolution into this is better than Healy would be.
I think it might actually just be playing a single Kiki and have the... I think it has all the combos in there.
Okay.
Pretty sure, because it's a tutor's deck. It's playing four Eldritch Evolution.
Right.
And Voice of Resurgence and all that stuff.
And I guess... What our plan is instead of Sahili Ray and Felidar Guardian, you have Restoration Angel and Seraph, whatever.
Yeah, I think it's honestly...
And it's more free and less, like, playing that Angel land, like, has minimal cost.
And it's an untapped land, so which is, like, the shockingly best part about it is that you don't... As long as your mana base can support having that colorless land in your deck, you're pretty well positioned.
Right.
I like, beat a Boggles player with it, and it was, like, kind of fascinating. So I'll quickly talk about the matchups, and then we'll probably move on to the Pro Tour stuff.
Yeah.
But I played against... I can't remember the exact order, but I definitely played against Boggles. I beat Boggles. I played against Humans, and I beat Humans. Both were tight, three-game matches. Both were won with the combo. One of the two combos. I was able to beat...
How many times did you combo with both Angels and the land?
Twice.
Okay.
Twice in the tournament. I think I'm pretty sure I dropped after round six. I played six rounds, and I think in the end, my record was like 3-2-1, maybe?
Okay.
I think. I timed out against a guy in like round two or three who was playing a control deck. I think he was playing like actual control. No, he was playing Tron. That's what it was. He was playing Tron, and I would have beaten him on the next turn. He did Ultimate Ugin against me, which I've never had that happen before. But it's crazy. Has somebody ever ultimated an Ugin against you?
No, I don't even... It's the opposite end of Nicol Bolas, right?
It's draw seven, gain seven...
And play a thing for free.
No, but seven permanents from your hand in play. It's so ludicrous. Like, in a deck with that many giant things...
Interesting.
Yeah, it was crazy. He was, like, doing it. He was, like, resolving his Ugin. And I was looking at my hand. I was like, okay, if I can survive next turn, I can probably combo him. I was like, he has to play, and he just was like, Wurmcoil Engine, Karn, Emrakul, or like whatever, like, you know, Ulamog. I was like, okay, there's no way. Like, all my permanents are gone. So that was wild. That was one matchup. I did play against the blue-red Drake deck, or the Phoenix deck, and Crackling Drake is really good. That was the card that scared me the most. Phoenixes were fine. Like, Path to Exile on a Phoenix, I'm okay with.
You go Path to Restoration usually. Both of them kind of just like stop a Phoenix in its tracks.
Yeah, and the other like thing in the ice is, again, you can just get rid of it. You can path it. You bring, like, snap and path means that like they're pretty threat light, but the Drake, you have to have path for because your bolt doesn't get it, and it's so big.
And there's no setup for them. They just kind of play it, draw a card, and then... And pathing a Drake is... Like, we were talking about this before that we started recording. I don't know if I would ever be that sad if I had to play a spell that said 4 mana, put a land into play for my deck, draw a card. Like, I wouldn't play that on purpose, but the fact that that's where you end up with that card when someone paths it is, like, fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, kind of like the worst Solemn Simulacrum ever.
It's Solemn Simulacrum that they, like, kill.
Yeah.
Like, they bolt your Solemn Simulacrum, which always...
Well, you're also... Bad. I mean, if it's get a land into play and draw a card and they discard a card...
Yeah, yeah. That's yeah, you're good, right. Actually. Yeah, it's a discard, too. Like, all three of those things, that's a card that would probably see some weird amount of control play. Not, like, a lot, but, like, I can imagine it happening.
Draw, discard, ramp? I don't know. That probably actually sees play. I don't think it sees play if it costs blue, blue, red, red. Because that's, like, pretty restrictive.
Sure.
But yeah, I like...
Would that card be black, green? Yeah. It would be, like, a black, green, and two.
You would probably lose a life, also, is my guess. You would draw a card, lose a life, they would discard a card.
Put a land in the play?
Maybe they would discard a card and gain a life, because it would be black and green or something.
I don't think the life loss needs to be there.
I'm just thinking the symmetrical nature of it.
Sure.
Yeah. Something like that. I don't know. But anyway...
Lose life, they gain a life. Yeah, okay. Reverse drain.
Yeah, or maybe it's that you... No, you would never be able to gain a life. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, I can't remember all of the matchups. There was probably... I played against one player. It was like, green-white. No, he was playing, like, rock creatures. It was basically rock creatures with Hardened Scales and Winding Constrictor. So it was just, like, a good stuff three-color deck with Hardened Scales and Winding Constrictor. It was playing Night of Autumn and, like, Scavenging Ooze. And it was good, pretty powerful. That was like late in the day, so we were both out of contention at that point. It was kind of a weird deck.
Okay.
But you know, powerful creatures. So that was pretty much my matchups for the day. I enjoyed playing Kessel Run. It just felt clunky this time. The mana base and the way that it matched up with the cost, it just felt really slow.
Yeah, I think we found a thing that's good, and that thing that's good is not a Planeswalker control deck. Not that a Planeswalker control can't be good, but I think the thing that you found that's good doesn't want to be in that shell.
Yeah, I would almost say, like, I would almost have been happy with no Jaces, just the Teferis, maybe. Because, like, playing Teferi is sweet because of the untap ability, and it allows you to still hold open your path or your Lightning Bolt or your Counterspell. Right. And that's so important in that deck, is to be able to at least be kind of reactive while still advancing your game plan.
But would it be better just to be aggressive ahead of that and, like, just have, like, creatures that stop your opponent from doing stuff?
Maybe, yeah. It might just be better to not play any of the Planeswalkers. Yeah. So we'll keep working on it, but I won't be playing it in March because I'm playing an established net deck.
Unless this deck does well. So now it's your job,
yeah.
People listening and watching, to Top 8 and GP before, or Top 8 and SCG event before March.
Brandon, I will send you a list.
with a list so that Ben can play it.
So
watch me like, what, like, because I technically I could just play this list.
You could.
And you have to play a good list. And then I just can, like, and then I'll top 8 the tournament and you'll be mad forever.
Sad. I suggest before we get into our discussion of the Pro Tour, should we knock out this other box topper?
Sure, you can open it on camera. Now, this is just, I bought these. These are for me, but we thought it'd be more exciting if I opened these on camera
with
you guys.
The first one we did in the pre-show stream, we opened it, and it was this beautiful Through the Breach right here, though we had not hit record on our audio, so we started the episode over, so that is only available to those of you that were watching that part of the stream.
All right, so once again, it is a Deckmaster game. Ben gets to see it first.
That's pretty sweet. You're going to be excited about this.
All right, double excited, switching around.
Yeah.
Everyone. Ooh, we were just talking about this.
Yeah.
Kitchen Finks.
Finks. Sweet. Finks is a good one.
There we go. We were talking about how people are kind of down on Finks as one of the cards that you can get out of the box topper. But the fact that, like, it's kind of like Ornithopter out of the old experiment, or not experiments. The
Masterpieces?
The Masterpieces, where because Ornithopter is a 4 of in established decks in Modern, it ends up being a really important Masterpiece versus, like, a card that just, like, was more expensive before then, or, like, that's been printed on the ground.
What's your feeling as somebody who... Look, what is your feeling on, like, premium versions of Magic cards? Because at this point, we have so many different premium versions and all different varieties. You love them?
Yeah, and to the extent that, like, I'm happier. Like, I think the buy-a-box promos that they do for sets should just be Modern stuff like this. They should just be Masterpieces of cool old cards. Because, like, I think they're towing a line where cards printed from those box opener sets like, if they're constructed playable, people will have a problem with it, or they're bad, and then people don't want them. And so, like, where do they, who are they making happy with that card? Versus if this version of Kitchen Finks came with the Guilds of Ravnica set, or like an old Ravnica card version of this kind of frame came with Guilds of Ravnica when you buy a box, everyone's happy about it. Like, no one's, it's not in standard, so no one's unhappy. It's worth money, so people are happy they're getting it with their box. It costs Wizards pretty minimal amounts. It gets reprints into the market. I think, like, cool promos like this don't hurt anyone. And we, I mean, like, we talked about this when Ultimate Masters was spoiled, and maybe I didn't really talk about it as much because you guys did the Ultimate Masters episode without me. But in general, I don't think having expensive sets like Ultimate Masters are a net negative.
I agree. I think that we got a little inundated with Master sets this last year, and I think that it reduced a little bit of the excitement, and there's a premium value when you look at a Master set card that I think you want to feel. Like, do you still, when I look at, like, when I look at a Modern Masters 1 card, I, like, see the symbol, and it feels, like, somewhat like, oh, this is, like, old and cool and, like, a little bit valuable. When I look at an Iconic Masters card, I'm like,
oh, what is this? And I think part of that is, there's so much good, like, playing Modern Masters 1, like, and we were paying $14 back then, because that was before they raised the $10 SRP, and then so stores are just charging $14, because we didn't know how limited the print run was going to be, and it was really limited. And in that environment, it was fine. And, like, no one needs to play this set. It's fine that there's a premium expensive set that's out there, because it's, by not being able to play Ultimate Masters, you're not missing out on Tournament Magic. You're not missing out on a GP. You're not unable to play Modern, unable to play Standard. There's not, like, a barrier to play those things.
Right.
But this allows them to print a much more exciting product that has a lot more reprints, which does affect the market more positively than Ultimate Masters, which is just, like, boring and no one wanted. Not Ultimate Masters, sorry. Iconic Masters.
I'm excited about this set. I like the Master sets in general. And not only that, but I really like premium versions of cards. Like, I'm looking at these and I'm just like, God, these are gorgeous. I would love to have four of all of these. Like, you know, and I feel the same way still about the Expeditions when I see them. I feel the same way still about, like, when I see the Masterpieces, the Invocations even. Honestly, as weird as they are, I like having decks that are, like, unique and blinged out. Like, I think it's really exciting. Like, in my Highlander decks...
Oh, yeah. Invocations are the only way I was able to afford a foil Force of Will, so I'm all about them.
Yeah, and, like, my Highlander decks are, like, peppered through with just, like, little... You know, I have three Beta Islands in one of them, and I've got, like, a couple Expeditions that I bought at one point. It's fun to have that variety in your decks, especially in formats like EDH and, you know, or like Commander and, like, Highlander, where it's one-ups. You know, Singleton makes it especially appealing to have...
People are excited about the red-white and either green or not green Saheeli Ray. Or not Saheeli Ray, sorry. The Felda Guardian Angel Land.
Yeah, I think it's list. Sweet. Somebody said, I saw in the chat, somebody suggested Nahiri, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, people were suggesting that when I posted the list online. I think what's cool about the deck, going back to that, sorry, is all the pieces work together well. It's as if you had a Kiki Jiki. Like, it's a Splinter Twin combo deck, but it's a little bit more expensive.
Yeah.
But both... Deceiver Exarch and what's the fairy?
Deceiver Exarch and
it's been so long.
Pestermite?
Pestermite. Both combo with each other.
Yeah, I think the one thing about Felidar Guardian that I thought was really cool, and I was trying to figure out a way to do this, but in white red, there's not really a good way to do it. Blinking a Planeswalker feels really good. That's one of the coolest things the Felidar Guardian's capable of doing.
Like you can minus her, then blink her the next turn,
yeah,
and plus her.
That's really powerful. So I think that's notable. I mean, it's a little tough that it's a 4-drop and all the good Planeswalkers are 4 and 5 drops in that color. Like, I'm not forgetting a really good white or red or white-red 3-mana Planeswalker, right?
No. But, like, the two good white-red Planeswalkers are, I think they're the only, yeah, the two good ones are Johnny and Nahiri.
Because, like, you have 3-mana Chandra creature, that's the red 3-drop, and you have, like...
Well, there's a bunch of red 3, or there's a few red 3-drop ones, because there's Sarkon, the new dragon one, who's not...
Yeah, there's the Sarkon, right? That doesn't do
good
anything
for this.
You. Yeah, and there's not the white, there's a white Ajani, a double strike Ajani. That doesn't do anything for you. So, yeah, it's...
I don't know if Planeswalker's where you want to be. Yes, it's good to blink it with Felder. And Nahiri's a great one. I think you play Nahiri, and I think you have Ajani's in the side,
because
he's, like, a great sideboard card. And you just go with, like, aggressive threats. You cut Wall of Omens because it's, like, not the best thing.
Yeah.
You can have Wall of Omens. Yeah, it's
You could play Flicker Wisp in this deck, too.
Yeah, my list had it. It's not as good as
slow.
It's a little slow.
Yeah. So
I'm not playing with Amulet, necessarily, because getting... Not Amulet.
Aetherville. Yeah. So that is going to wrap up our discussion of Grand Prix Portland. The event was won by Grixis Shadow, which is cool. I think Shadow is reasonably well positioned right now. It's a good deck. It's nice to see that it was like the deck, and then it kind of fell out of favor, and now it's back. It continues to kind of win tournaments and keep showing up, and it's really powerful. It's a great deck, and I actually think at this point it's a good deck to have in the format. It's kind of a tempo deck in some ways.
Okay.
Right? Like, it's kind of the best version of, like, a Delver deck you could ever ask for.
Sure.
Because it's not... You're not playing a one-drop threat in that deck, but you're very disruptive. Stubborn Denial alongside your Dredge creatures and your Death Shadow, it's, like, a really good way to stay ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And it shuts down the really linear combo decks because of all the disruption it's playing. And it makes you respect the fact that there are going to be decks interacting with you. And I like that. I think that's good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So... anyway,
yeah.
I suggest we get into the discussion of the Mythic Championships.
All right, so.
Let's break it down.
Goodbye, Pro Tours.
Yeah.
Hello, Mythic Championships.
We don't get to call them Pro Tours anymore. They're called Mythic Championships. It's now only Magic Fests and Pro Tour, Magic Fests and Mythic Championships, right? That's what we have now?
Yes. Now, the fun thing about Magic Fest is that, what happened to my window? There it is. Cool. The fun thing about Magic Fest is that, like, have you been paying attention to the fact that there are, like, local Magic, like, the card trick type of Magic, like, events around the country called Magic Fests?
No. just another feather in the cap of all the idiots who ask us if we can do a Magic trick when we tell them we play Magic.
Oh, I came for the Magic Fest. Oh, no. Okay. all right, so these are the changes with Mythic Championships. In 2019, there will be 10 million in prizes across tabletop and digital Magic, including Arena. Introduction of Magic Pro League, 32 top-ranked players with contracts worth of $75,000 total.
Yep.
Among those 32. The Premier Magic... What?
Each.
Oh, each person can get up to $75,000?
That's the contracts for probably $75,000.
Yep. Interesting. Okay.
So we're going to have 32 actually paid Magic Pros via
Wizards of the Coast. So they each get a $75,000 a year.
Yeah, they get a salary contract to play Magic professionally.
Got it. The premier Magic tournaments are going to be Mythic Championships, and they can be a digital or paper events. So instead of Pro Tour, they will be both of these. The first digital Mythic Champion will be at PAX East in Boston, March 28 and 31st. The thing that they bring up of that is they had 6 Pro Tours. But next year, they're going down to 4, but it looks like there'll be multiple Magic Arena Mythic Championships instead.
It is a little curious. Go ahead.
Pro Tours are being rebranded as Mythic Championships. Each paper MC will award a $500,000 prize pool, so there'll be 4 of those next year. There are going to be 4 Mythic Championships in 2019, not 6 Pro Tours as previously announced. The Pro Tours in Dallas-Fort Worth and Sydney were canceled. Everyone who attends a Mythic Championship will receive some amount of prize money. However, Mythic Championships events after London, the second paper MC of 2019, will not offer travel awards, so you no longer get travel awards to go to them.
Yep.
The narrowly regionalized invitational scheme that was previously announced for Mythic Championships will not be in effect. There will be no Nationals for 2019. There will be no World's Cup for 2019. The 2018 and 2019 Pro Tour Team Series will be the last Team Series.
Mm.
Pro Players Club benefits will continue through the end of 2019, but Grand Prix Seattle will be the last event to award Pro Points.
When is Grand Prix Seattle?
I don't know. The Pro Tour Hall of Fame will be changing in 2019, though we don't know how.
Hey, Mike, can you check out when Grand Prix Seattle is? Thank you.
That was a lot.
So it's an enormous announcement. So the first thing that I think is a little curious, and this is something that I have always found a little bit strange.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that they announced the 6 Pro Tours thing, and then 2 months later they're announcing this. It feels like they were less sure of their decision, or the powers that be above were not on board as much.
I think 2 things happened. I think Magic Arena has been wildly more popular than they could have hoped. And they're still in open beta. Like, so from that perspective, they realized that they needed to modify their plan to incorporate Magic Arena.
Okay, that's fair.
I think the other thing that happened was that after they made that announcement, or right before they made an announcement, they created that Pro Tour, Pro Play brain trust. If there was specific terms that they had for all of this. And I think while working with them, they realized that they needed to kind of modify the system entirely. And with those two situations, they made this big change. I think one of those was the going from four to six to back to four was because they're all are adding multiple Magic Arena Magic Fest or Magic Championships or Mythic Championships. And because of that, they realized that that gives the opportunity for people to play at that level regardless. And so it made more sense to make that change. And I think the big regrettable thing is they should have just waited to make the six Pro Tour announcement, but they had to based on people's scheduling for next year and when they're like, they have to announce stuff.
So somebody in the chat just said, weird question mark. It's the most typical WotC thing ever. You're right. There has been a lack of organizational structure with their announcements over the years. Like there's definitely, we're going to do it this way. And then a year later it's, we're not, we're going to do it this way now. That is a thing. I don't know if I think that that's a thing that's just the problem with them. I mean, I think that's just, there's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of money at stake. And so there's multiple people that have input on these decision-making and there is a schedule in mind. They mm-hmm. have to hit certain dates.
Well, and stubbornness is not a sign of intelligence. Like the fact that they're willing to be flexible with what they're doing because they want to find the best possible system. And they've gone through a weird rapid growth where they had 20 years of like being fine and then like have recently just been modifying how their game plan works is good. I mean, I'd rather Wizards be trying new stuff and trying to figure stuff out. Yes, it's a little bit messing with people's lives, but if they were just like, nope, we're sticking our toe in the ground and we're not going to do anything different or change at all, like not only does this stuff not happen, but like double face cards don't happen and they refuse to try anything new, and then every other TCGs will overtake them and just be better.
And so yeah, you've got a handful of things going on here. I mean, one of them obviously is that there's a concern that Modo has crashed in terms of the secondary market and the value of the cards. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are really upset and they are, what's going to happen? I mean,
Saffron Olive had the best response to this, though, which was like, entire Magic community complains that Modo's dying because it's too expensive and they want it to be cheaper. Why don't they make things cheaper? Wizards makes it cheaper. Modo's dying because it's cheaper now. My collection no longer has money. So it's like,
people will always complain. I agree. There will always be complaints, and that's just a thing.
Because right now, Modo is the most inexpensive way to play Modern, Legacy, Vintage, and Cube.
Yeah.
Out there. Totally. I wave my hand after Cube because technically Cube is free in real life, but
yeah.
Someone had to pay to buy that Black Lotus.
So that's interesting. There's a couple different pathways that you can go when you think about the future of Magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that counterfeits are one of the most concerning parts of the game.
Sure.
And digital Magic completely gets rid of them. So that's...
You know, like, our counterfeit episode where we talked about them? That was the episode that we've received the most aggressively anti-us and our opinions comments. Like, in messages because of that episode. Which is fascinating.
What were our opinions that were so bad?
That counterfeits are bad.
Oh, people think that counterfeits... That's right. That's right. People, yeah.
There are people out there that aggressively think that counterfeits are a net positive for people that are playing Magic. And they are wrong.
Yeah. Well, the game just dies. But so that's one thing is that, you know, digital obviously is better for that.
Yep.
There is no, like, plan in the future anytime soon for Modern to exist on Arena. If Modern existed on Arena, we're in a whole different space because then I think you start to really lose a lot of the value of the paper cards. I think that significantly hurts it.
I disagree. Really? I think Magic Strength will always be paper card tournaments, people playing with each other in stores. If like, I think people, one of the reasons they play Magic is for the community around it, and going totally digital kills it. I also think Modern will never exist on Arena. I'm going to tell you that right now. It's never happening. They built Arena in a way. There are mechanics that are in Modern that don't work. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be a lot of the cards in Modern that are powerful that get reprinted eventually into Standard or into weird sets that make it work, because there are mechanics that do. But, like, for instance, I don't know if Miracles ever works in Arena. I don't know if they have even made the system allowable for a mechanic like Miracles to function.
What would be so hard about it? You would when you draw your card.
It was hard for when they did it on Modo. Like there's parts of the mechanics that they've built in the game.
It would, when it happens, it just, your opponent wouldn't see that you would get a trigger where it would like get all bright and like it's a light up thing, and you'd see the card for a second, and you would have 10 seconds or something.
Like other things like wishes, like are hard, and there's a wish right now on it, right? So wishes are fine. I think there's
what
stuff.
Wish?
They've basically said that there's mechanics from Magic's past that don't work very well in Arena. And
no,
I couldn't tell you what those are, but they made that statement. The other thing is, going back in time is hard. What I think is going to happen is eventually they'll just create Magic Origins. I'm using that as a starting point because it's only two sets behind where they're at currently.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the set they would pick, but they would pick a set that is... And maybe it's just where Kaladesh or wherever we're at now. Maybe it's just literally Ixalan Block is the beginning of new modern.
Well, like Hearthstone's been around for how long now? Four, five years maybe?
Yeah.
4 or 5 years? And they have Wild. You can play Wild in Hearthstone. That's
right.
Any card. It's not that long, but like it is a totally different format than just playing.
When Modern was created, it wasn't that long. And like it was, what?
8 years.
15 years of sets?
No.
8 years of sets?
Modern came
out in
2011, I think.
Yeah. So like that's not even that many years. So I think they could do that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think they'd probably do it very quickly. I think they would, like, I think the next rotation, they'd probably announce a modern-esque type format.
Yeah.
In it. And maybe what it is it's just singleton eternal. Like, people love singleton on Arena. It makes it so you don't have, like, you can even add Shadows over Innistrad, because we know that Shadows over Innistrad and Onward is in the game. Like the digital files are within the code for Arena. So they could just make it like all these sets are available, you only need one of every card, have fun. And
I mean, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how they develop it over the years. I mean, I think what you're saying is true, which is that the reaction has been very strong, which is why you get that commercial about everyone's gonna know your name. You saw that, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
If you, you know, everyone's gonna know your name.
The commercial is very weird.
Well, it's just, I mean, I think what it is
why was Sir Mix-a-Lot in it?
Sir Mix-a-Lot in the commercial?
That's the guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's because of Seattle, probably. That's why, because he's a famous Seattle.
Oh, okay.
And I'm from Seattle, so it was just like...
I don't know, everything about it was weird.
I think probably, you know, what we're experiencing a little bit is that while the esports boom has been happening, and we've all been clamoring for Magic to get on board, there's also been a sense that we've had that we have this one thing that's different than all those other games, which is that we have this paper card game where you can go and there's eight people in a store and you can draft, and like there's this history to it. It kind of felt like a very different and very unique thing, and you would call Magic an esport, but like we all kind of knew it wasn't that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Arena makes you feel like they are entering that world, and it's
well, this announcement more than that. Like, this announcement is them saying we are now an esport, and we already kind of were,
yeah,
because like there are features of Magic that were very esporty, regardless, because it was the closest thing to digital tournament play or tournament play that wasn't a actual sport
yeah.
that was successful. And I don't think esports exist the way they do without Magic actually having happened and doing that type of tournament play beforehand. But now they're just like, no, we're an esport. We have any products and we'll have paper one. And that's going to make we're unique, like that we have physical in-person gameplay. And it'll
probably
be really successful.
My point is that I think we're experiencing a little bit of the confusion of like, this is a company that's now trying to market themselves in a different way. To kids that view esports in a different way than Magic players view Magic. And so that commercial, I think, is them sort of trying to be like, we need to make this like cool and hip and exciting. I'm not saying they did it totally right. I'm just saying that that commercial, all of it, it's that.
Well, no, I mean, what that commercial is that Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast hired an actual marketing company that's doing it for them.
I also think, I mean, so let's react a little bit to the most important.
Which is how the announcement got made for Magic Fest early. I mean, they got leaked because a separate marketing company, like Hasbro hired a marketing firm to launch this marketing campaign for, and that's where this commercial came from.
Let's respond quickly to some of the most important details in the announcement.
Sure.
Okay? I think the first one is the $75,000 contracts for 32 players.
Great.
That's a big... That's a big game for Magic. That really shows that they're doubling down on we're paying you a livable salary
mm-hmm.
to play Magic the Gathering. 32 of you, not 5 or 10.
Sure.
But like that's enough people that you have like a whole interactive community online. If every one of those people is active on Twitter, 32 people is a lot of voices,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I guess my issue with the 32 people announcement, or my worry, and this is the worry I've heard from other people because it doesn't affect me at all, is that's a weird cap that makes it so it's really hard to actually become a professional Magic player as a career. Because unless you're the best 32 players, and there is some luck with how well you do, like if you looked at the best 32 players of the last 20 years, and like it's not as consistent unless you're top, like maybe the top 10 is consistent, but like without the Hall of Fame lock-in, I don't know how consistent you can like, I don't know if you could count on being a professional Magic player anymore.
I don't know that the 32 shouldn't be the only 32 players, right? Like, for instance, this is like if you get hired for coverage for Wizards or versus SCG. They're both very viable coverage teams
mm-hmm.
who are covering high-level Magic.
Sure.
Right? I don't know what either one of them pays, but, like, they probably are paying reasonably close, and they're both hiring credible people.
Right.
In theory, if they have 32 people with $75,000 contracts, you're going to start to see other companies recognizing the value of this, and it's going to start. I think they're trying to kickstart the idea of esports teams within Magic, where they're going to get real salaries from bigger companies that want to double down on this, and them saying, as the company that owns this, mm-hmm. we're going to make it possible for the best 32 players at its inception to have careers. You other guys can have that too, and I think that's a pretty big deal. That's a bigger deal in the support of the pro community than Magic's done in a very long time.
So I have a question: if you were a Magic player that was good enough to possibly make the top 32, would you take a $50,000 a year contract to forego the $75,000 you'd make from Wizards if you hit that level?
Sorry, would I take a $50,000 contract?
So I'm a TCG player, and okay, I find eight pros that are all probably good enough, or like have at different times shown me that they're good enough to make it into the top 32. They're not currently there, or they are, and I tell them, I will pay you $50,000 for 5 years.
Oh, gotcha.
If you hit the $75,000 mark, I get $25,000.
Well, a couple things. I don't really know how it works as far as prize money goes. I'm assuming that you have to split.
And your prize money gets distributed among the people playing with you on your team.
Probably.
Would you vote for a consistent paycheck over?
I would take a 1 year $50,000. I might take a 2 year.
Then why would you take it? Because $75,000 gets you that 1 year.
So you're saying before they make their selections? Like, you're saying when they announce this, before they ink their players, TCG comes out to, it's one of these companies comes
like
out
to they go to LSV, they go to sure. Josh Otherladen, they go to Gary, you know, all the top whatever.
Yeah,
they find enough of them, they're like, we'll guarantee you get this for the next 5 years if you promise to distribute your winnings among your team and us, including the $75,000 you get.
I would not at any point in time as a working adult who has any interest in being like a functioning member of society, to buy a home at some point, to marry someone, anything.
Sure.
Take a 5-year $50,000 contract if it meant that I was basically capped, like, because
you're not, this isn't your day-to-day job. You're not like, you would have the ability to go work as you regularly do now. Like, Magic players don't make $50,000 a year on average playing Magic.
On average, for sure. Then maybe, because 32 is not very many players.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I do it for 5, though. I think it's too aggressive. I think if you're saying, 2 to 3 years, maybe. I think if it's a 2-year, $50,000 contract.
Because sure. A lot of people's complaints right now is that they have no idea. They don't know if they can feel comfortable putting in the effort for $75,000 a year if they can't guarantee for the next 3 years they have an opportunity to get that $75,000.
I think where the part of this that is the most interesting is, if you want to be successful in any industry, if you want to stand out, you want to rise to the top, you're doing more than just taking that handout, right?
Sure.
It's not a handout because you're working hard for it, but like, if you really believe you deserve to be one of the top 32 players, then you're marketing yourself. You're trying to get sponsors. You're streaming. You're selling merch. You know what I'm saying? You're doing more than just that $75,000. You have a deal worked out that if you win, you're still actually benefiting greatly. Like, I don't think it's just like 75 and that's it. I think you can take your 50 as long as you're doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you are truly marketing yourself to be a pro in Magic and that's going to be your career, then I think you can do it. If it's like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting, though. But I the bottom line is, I think it's a good step for Wizards in the right direction. It sends the right message.
Right.
And I hope that it inspires the other companies that have the budgets to do it and them in the future to get to put more players
there. My biggest complaint of this whole announcement is that there's actually, like, for how much information they gave us, they did not give us enough for a lot. Like, for instance, if you're in the running to make gold to this year, right now, do you go to the next GP?
Because gold's basically gone. Is that what's gone?
Like, and what is it worth it to you to go to the next GP? Like, would you book a trap? Like, would you go to Florida if you're like in the running for gold? Where, like, yesterday or 5 days ago, if before they made this announcement, if I was in the running for gold, actually, I would go to the next GP, regardless of where it was in the United States, probably.
I think their idea is that if we're gonna make an omelet, we're gonna break a few eggs.
I agree, and I think like all the pro community is like, I am worried, but this is in the long term going to be better. And it's kind of a little bit of what you were saying earlier, where we have we've been asking forever for Magic to treat professional Magic like an esport, to actually take this seriously. And 5 days ago, they said, okay.
Yeah, and it's just we have to see how it unfolds. I mean, I think a little bit of like, if they look at their pro community and they say, if we lose 25% of these players because we're doing things differently and they are holding on to this thing they've worked hard for, it's a real bummer and we feel bad about it. But the health of this game long term and the health of the pro community long term is going to be built on this, not that.
Well, and on the reverse end of it, Brian Kibler's back. Like, pros that left Magic for Hearthstone, because Arena is around, are coming back out of the woodwork to Magic. Because Magic is a better game than Hearthstone.
Yeah.
It always has been, and it will always, well, maybe not always be, but for the time being, I see it being better. And Magic Arena versus Hearthstone versus Magic the Gathering Online, and the viability of making a career in being a personality around those games.
Yeah.
Hearthstone was just a much more viable option until just now.
Yeah.
And, like, while this whole thing is happening on this end, the streaming community is also getting a huge boon to it just by the fact that Magic Arena is good.
Yeah.
Like, we're literally had a discussion before this we started recording on, you know, other content that we could be making.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've always been like, well, we could stream, but Modo sucks. And, you know, we've been a little resistant to maybe streaming Arena because our audience is modern focused. But, you know, in reality, you streaming Arena, just starting, would probably be really beneficial because, A, you can do weird, cool stuff on Arena. They have cool events. For instance, Brian Kibler is doing a big monsters series for the next month where it's like, or the next week, where every card over 4 converted mana cost that's a creature, you draw a card. Just as like a rule that's in the game. And so that's a benefit. So it's encouraging you to play big creatures.
Hmm.
That's like a cool format they've created for the next week.
Interesting.
Or in 2 weeks. And so like stuff like that is stuff that you, being Wacky Brew person, could have a lot of fun with on Arena that's on brand. And even though it's not modern, is within the framework of stuff that would be cool for our fans to watch. And we'd love to hear your guys' thoughts, people listening and people watching, on us doing live streaming or just Arena content onto YouTube. And if that's something you'd be interested in, even though it's not modern.
Yeah.
I think that, like, with these pro contracts, with, like, third-party pro contracts are not coming from TCG Player. I think the idea is that they would come from esports organizations like Cloud9 or TSM or somebody like that would be, you know, putting more money into the Magic pro infrastructure by fielding a team. Because they all have Hearthstone teams. Some of them have, like, you know, teams for other digital TCGs. But Magic has been untouched by that so far.
Right.
So if you guys couldn't quite hear that, just in case, on the mics here, Michael was basically saying that the encouragement by Wizards putting this money on the contract should encourage these other esports organizations like Cloud9 or TSM to put money behind an organizational structure to have teams that are supported in the way that other esports have, which is true. I mean, and I think that that's totally valid, and I hope that that is what happens. So
do we have an exact breakdown on what you need to do to be in that 32 players?
Nope, they haven't given it to us. More details to follow, as usual.
More details to follow.
Yeah, so we don't know, Jim Scott, who asked, is it top 32 or the, just the top 32 contracted player? We don't know what to be in that 32 means. And my guess is it's a combination of win X events, types of events you get in probably, have X amount of you did well this year types of things, and then probably some other third category that's more indeterminate.
Can we, before we run out of time here, what else on that list do you think is most relevant? I mean, I guess the next big thing to talk about is the fact that historically, I don't know the exact number, somebody probably knows this, the increase to a $10 million prize pool for 2019 has to be at least 100%, right? Like we have to have gone from 5 million to 10 or 4 million to 10 because we were getting 4 pro tours previously at 250 and then a bunch of Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, now each pro tour is $500,000. The Magic Fests through Arena are going to have some non-announced value in what you get awarded.
I don't know what the actual increase is, but I know that it's more. I'm guessing it's at least 5 million more, and we know that a lot of that money comes from travel rewards and hotels and a lot of these things that they're not paying. But at the same time, it looks better, and it is better to say, if you play Magic in 2019 and you play it competitively, there's $10 million on the line, right? I mean, even if we're just assuming, and we don't know this, but like if we're just assuming that the fact that they're doubling the money they're giving out at a Pro Tour, at a Mythic Championship, as they're called, you used to win 50 grand. If it's doubled, you're going to win $100,000 to win a Mythic Championship.
Mm-hmm.
100 grand. That's a lot of money.
Right.
It's a huge amount of money.
Right.
In winning a pro tour in the past after taxes, you'd walk with about 37K.
Right.
Double that, you know? You're making a year's salary at a pretty decent job if you win a pro tour, a year. Like 70 grand after taxes is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a big deal, and I think the 10 million number really resonates with me. I mean, I don't love the travel reward stuff because I think it does eliminate some of the romantic appeal that Magic used to have in that sense.
But they already got rid of it for most of the Hall of Fame side of things. And so, like, who was really getting was people who won the local tournaments, like DTQs. I can imagine local game stores, if it's really a clamoring for that, offering, if you win my PTQ, I will include a $250 travel voucher to the Pro Tour.
Like, well, I think $250 is not going to do much for you. You have to fly to, like, Dublin. I mean,
but that's what stores are, like, I mean, like, a lot of times that way you were, I mean, maybe 500 then, but like,
I would say based on the number of players, right? That's where you do it. You scale, you make it scalably. Like, you figure, okay, if this is a constructed PTQ,
I don't think you can really make it scalable. I think it's like, I'm going to give you a percent, because you'll know when the PTQ is happening, what Pro Tour is it for. It's not like, oh, you'll get a random Pro Tour available to you.
Right. Okay. So if it's like Mythic Championship that's in Sacramento, then it's like $250. And if it's like Mythic Championship that's in Dublin, then you're like, I'm going to have to make this reasonable. It's going to have to be constructed, not limited. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to take 25 at the door. I'm going to make this much, and I'll have $500 or $800 right. that I can give out as the travel.
Because the store's not actually making money through their tournament fees. They're making it through singles sold at that tournament. So.
Well, I mean, they do make money on those constructed tournaments. The constructed ones.
The amount of money they make from entry fees compared to...
Well, definitely they make more on singles, but I'm saying, think about it. They run a tournament at their store on a day and 35 people show up. And those 35 people spend $25 to enter the tournament, and it's constructed tournament. They bring their own cards. It costs the store literally not a dollar to
That's
run that
not
tournament.
True.
What does it cost? What does it cost
the store
to run?
Multiple employees.
Pay a judge.
Pay a judge.
And the staff is going to be there late because Magic tournaments, like PTQs, you're running like... You know, six rounds because top eight.
Come over, come over to microphones so that people can hear you, because this is good enough of an explanation that, because I know this, but not everyone does.
All right, yeah, I used to run tournaments at a store. So, like, for a PPTQ, you're paying, like, more staff to be there because you need somebody managing the tournament as well as managing the register. And then if you do other business, like you sell other board games or comic books or whatever your store is doing, you need somebody handling that as well. So chances are you're paying a person to be there. You also need to be paying at least one judge, in addition to, you know, the store staff, and you are paying them maybe a store credit or a box or something, but it's, you know, it's a relevant amount of money you have to pay the judge. And then you also are probably there a long time, so you're, like, paying people more than they would be getting just to be there for a normal day of business because you're open late because it's, like, six rounds plus cuts top eight or something. So, yeah, it is expensive
and
to run tournaments, and you're
prize
usually,
money in general.
And prize, yeah. You have to be giving a generous prize, especially in an area like LA where there's, like, tons of stores you can drive to. Like, people are not
every single PPTQ. They're going to the ones that are, like, appealing to them. So you have to be giving a good prize. So, yeah, you're
making money off of, like, publicity, like, people having a good experience at your store and maybe coming back later and singles, but you're not making that much money off the actual entry fee.
Solid explanation. Thank you, Michael. I'm wrong. It does cost money to run a constructed tournament.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I guess.
And then, like, prize, but they make a ton of money on a constructed tournament more than the draft from selling singles. And that's the point.
And the brutal part about that is, like, I bought my ninth Lightning Helix at this tournament because I only had two and I needed a third. Like,
right.
That's, like, the why they make money at these things is because you show up and, like, you just don't have what you need. And if you're going to play, you just have to buy it.
Well, so it's something that I think, I don't know if everyone knows this either, is... there are a few stores that make a ton of money at GPs, but most stores go to GPs to buy cards.
Yeah.
Because they need card stock for their store at home, and that's where they're making most of their money. And so they go to GPs more to actually build stock and do a buying trip where they can get a lot of stuff from a lot of people that aren't in their community normally. And then when they go home, they now have that stock available to sell to players.
Which is, like, really why the SCG circuit is able to live. It's because they have hit a critical mass of players that come to these things with an organizational structure that is strong enough,
right.
They're the only game in town there. So every card bought is just going on their website.
Right.
Every card sold. So that's why SCG...
One of the reasons I think the SCG tournament circuit happened, they're like, oh, we're running these tournaments. We need more cards.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the best way to get them.
Yeah. So I think those are the two biggest. I mean, I think the player contracts and the $10 million prize pool, I think those are both really big deals. I mean, Alex, are there any other details on that list that you think stand out beyond the 32 players and the $10 million that are the biggest? Like,
mostly just like the stuff, like, we don't know what 32 players, how they selected. Like, I wish they had more information on the way they're doing stuff. And I think some of it they don't know. I think some of it they're figuring out for sure. And they were getting feedback with these announcements to see where people are at on where things are happening. I think they, like, were like, well, we don't know what players will want more. Do they want the 32 players to be Hall of Fame players, or do they want them to be the best players? Well, why don't we announce that they will exist and then get ideas from the community during that process? And I think the last one is that there's some stuff that they, like, know what they're doing, but for legal reasons, they haven't perfectly ironed out what it is exactly, and they don't want to make the announcement until they do, because there will be legal promises behind it, so so much money is involved.
Interesting.
Like, if they were announced today during this tournament, like, oh, every winner of a GP makes it, gets invited to a whatever, and then
yeah, right.
and 6 months they find out they're like, oh, that doesn't work for this reason because Magic Arena is involved now, and how does that work? Then they have to change it. That's a problem.
Yeah. Last question for you before we go.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the big push on Arena means for the future of Moto?
I think Moto's fine. I think it becomes much more of a niche play area, but it allows, like, right now the cheapest way to play Modern is on Moto.
Yeah.
Cheapest way to play it.
It's not that, like, expensive.
Legacy and Vintage is, like, insanely cheap on Moto. You can buy, I think, every card on Moto for less than $10,000 is something like that I saw. And so, like, that's good, because I think that'll keep Moto alive. I think the fact that you just always play these cool older formats. For instance, I will never draft Innistrad again unless I play it on Moto.
Yeah.
And Innistrad is the best gaming experience I probably, like, top 10 gaming experiences of my life. So
it's
like,
also possible that Arena and, like, the visibility to Magic that Arena brings will actually get more players on Moto because mm-hmm. they'll be curious. They're used to playing digital Magic. They can't play Modern. They want to try it out. Now they basically understand the Magic's mechanics, so they can just, like, port over pretty easily.
Right.
It's totally possible that that's actually what happens. And then from there, they're like, well, this experience on this, like, kind of unsupported digital format is not as fun. I'm going to get into physical Modern because it's, like, way sweeter.
Yeah, and I think eventually, like, 5 years, 10 years from now, Moto could die. Like, that could happen.
Yeah.
I think that only really happens once there's some amount of an eternal scene on Arena that is comparable. And even then, I think we have a long time until that happens. And in the meantime, have fun playing Vintage.
Yeah.
Because it's sweet.
All right, guys, I think that's going to wrap us up for the day. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. As always, be sure to check out our Twitter at the MMCast. We have
Absolutely.
A Patreon. It's like a big deal that we ask for your support.
All the little things like the new microphones and us doing these live streaming content and how we're going to figure out how to actually accomplish all of this. The only reason we're able to do it is the small amount of money we make on Patreon. And the more we get, the quicker we're able to accomplish these goals.
We move through it and... you know, it's a little bit of money every month and we kind of save it up and then we'll spend it on something like new mics or something to make the show a little better. And the support from you guys is how we can keep making the show better. So please help us. Please help us continue to make the show a strong product. We want to keep making it better for you guys and try to improve the audio and all the things. Subscribe, like, comment, YouTube. It's the other biggest deal for us right now is growing this online, this video community.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, I think we're going to be done. We already shout out Jimmy and Josh. Did that happen? Did we talk about
Command Zone? Jimmy and Josh, Command Zone. Jimmy's back, right? Is he back on the Command Zone or is he just back
in
town?
I'm not really sure, but he's back in town.
Yeah. So
all I ever see from that guy are like shirtless flexing pictures and being famous now.
He's ripped. He had a fake beard for some reason.
Yeah.
He showed a picture of it. It was cool. Yeah, I think like all the stuff on Collective Company is great. Us, but then Game Nights, Command Zone, and the new show that I always forget, Extra Turns which Josh showed a funny video because they made Extra Turns in the format of Extra Turns specifically to make it kind of easier to edit and pump out content, but Josh is so OCD and good at like needs everything to be perfect and hardworking that like the thread is just as complicated.
Yeah.
Did not bite off more than they could chew.
No.
And yeah, those guys are great. Love them.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week with, I think, a top 10 episode. So
maybe.
See you guys soon.
Bye. Love you. Miss you.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.